certain weaknesses in human nature. Hence, until human nature changes perceptibly, there is little possibility that there will be a shortage of marks for con games. So if anyone is a potential mark, how does the con artist choose the mark to begin with? How to pick out the best one for this particular game, the one most likely to fall quickly and profoundly? That's what grifters are particularly good at, looking at a sea of faces and finding the one who, at this point in time, would be the perfect mark. It's the first step of the confidence game, the put-up, and no one is better at it than Apollo Robbins, the so-called gentleman thief famed for his sleights of hand in even the tightest of circumstances. Two career highlights? Stealing the president's top-secret itinerary from a Secret Service man, and removing the cartridge from a pen belonging to Penn of Penn and Teller fame. As Robbins told me over dinner one evening, he never just steals willy-nilly. First, he cases. He observes. He profiles. Only then does he begin his act. Chapter 2. The Put-Up. I can spot someone's weakness a mile away. In any room, I can pick out the best target. Simon Lovell, former con artist. Deborah Saulfield was heartbroken. A professional dancer and ballroom dance instructor, she had been working at what she saw as a dream job, marketing for a Times Square dance company. But in July 2008, within a two-day stretch, she had lost job and boyfriend both. Deborah had been splitting her time between Florida and New York. Florida was home, where she had her house and her three children, but New York would be soon, she'd hoped. There was the job, and, well, her boyfriend was going to propose any day. Now, however, she was in the West Village not to move the rest of her things permanently up to the city, but to move whatever she'd left out of her now ex's apartment. The next day, she was scheduled to fly back to Florida. The packing was emotionally grueling, each item a reminder of a life she'd no longer have. Deborah walked down the stairs. She needed to clear her head. A walk would do her good. It was then that she saw it. A sleek triangle of a building on the corner of 7th Avenue South and Bleecker Street, immediately familiar to anyone in the neighborhood. The home of Zania, the clairvoyant. Deep blue awnings adorned by a single gold Z. A heavy gold frame by the entrance, offering everything from palm readings to horoscope charts. Crimson and gold curtains with thick tassels, also gold, cover the windows, inviting you to peer inside another world. Come in, the whole facade seems to beckon, and all your troubles will be over. Walk-ins welcome, the sign brightly declares. Deborah had walked past it many times. Her boyfriend, ex-boyfriend, had warned her to stay far away. It wasn't a good place. Now, though, she slowed her step. It couldn't hurt, could it? Almost out of rebellion, he couldn't tell her what to do. She opened the door. Inside, it was even more opulent than she'd envisioned. Beaded curtains, hanging plants, ornate lanterns adorning the ceiling, a sign advertising Zania's second office in Cannes. Could Zania see her? She inquired. Sylvia Mitchell sat upstairs, awaiting her next customer. She lived in Mystic, Connecticut, the irony of her hometown surely inescapable even to her, and she'd been working as a, well, mystic for over a decade. In most every way, Zania was her home. The door opened. There was Deborah, tall, thin and elegant, long strawberry blonde hair streaming down her back. She moved with a smooth grace. A dancer, perhaps? She looked to be older than Sylvia herself. The clairvoyant had just turned 36, and she appeared a bit lost. Deborah, in turn, saw an attractive 30-something with a welcoming face. Very charming, very comforting, very pretty, dressed nicely, she would later recall. She was here, she told her, for a basic psychic reading, one of Zania's entry options, at a mere $75. Sylvia Mitchell carefully took Deborah's palm and began to talk. Almost immediately, it was as if a greater force took over, A pained look came over her face. There was something else there. She had very important information that could help her change and better her life. But it would cost her $1,000, she told Deborah, according to one detective's statement. $1,000 was a lot of money, but Sylvia seemed open and sincere. And her time was, of course, valuable. Maybe this was the thing she needed to make everything better. The job loss, the ruined love life. My heart was pounding out of my chest, Deborah later remembered. She handed over a check. All of a sudden, Mitchell's flash of insight crystallized. In her past life, she told Deborah, she'd been an Egyptian princess. As a royal, she had grown rather too attached to material possessions. She told me I was part of a ruling city, a good doer, but I had a problem, Saulfield later told jurors. That materialistic attachment was creating negative energy in her life, and that energy, in turn, was bubbling over into her love and professional lives. But, Mitchell told her, there was a solution. In order to get my life back in order, there was something I needed to do, Deborah said. She could hand over $27,000 as an exercise in letting go of wealth. Sylvia would keep it for her in a jar, and she could have it back any time she so desired. Saulfield had recently divorced. She knew she would need a financial cushion, what with three children, so she had taken out a line of credit on her house for emergency money. She decided to tap into the supply. It seemed like emergency enough. At the time, it felt like it was an emergency because I was very unstable, she says. Anyway, Sylvia had promised she could have it back. Deborah gave Mitchell a check for $27,000. I needed some direction and guidance, and she said she was pretty confident that she could help me. I don't know that I thoroughly trusted her, but I wanted to listen to words of comfort, she told jurors. I had a meltdown. I lost it. I was unable to keep myself together. The next morning, however, she regretted her haste. Her judgment had been clouded, she said. Thinking quickly, she went to her bank. Could she stop the check? Too late, she was told. It had already been cashed. So Deborah called Zania. Could she have a refund, she asked Mitchell. She'd parted with her money, just as she'd been ordered to do, but now she wanted to reconnect with it. I called her immediately and told her I made a mistake and needed my money back, she says. Not possible, Mitchell told her. She was sorry, but the money simply wasn't available. Saulfield was adamant. By this time, she was back in Florida, but the loss was too great. She couldn't afford it, and neither could her children. It was worth an extra flight. She returned to the city, anxious for the return of her $27,000. Her calls went unanswered, so she went in person. One time, she recalls, she stood in front of the parlor for the better part of a day, ringing the buzzer some 15 times. No one answered. Deborah alerted the police and in short order hired a lawyer and private investigator. If she couldn't get her money back herself, maybe they would be more persuasive. Most people are intuitive psychologists in their daily lives, wondering why people think or behave as they do, says Nicholas Epley, a University of Chicago psychologist who studies how we perceive others and what can make some of us more accurate than others in those perceptions. From the moment we see someone, we form impressions of who they are, what they're like, whether we're likely to get along with them or not. The process happens almost instantaneously. Some research shows that we make certain judgments, like trustworthiness or likely level of power, within fractions of a second, and that those judgments then endure, no matter how much longer our conversation lasts. And it happens unconsciously. Unless we're actively people-watching and trying to make predictions about strangers' backgrounds, lives, and desires, a vaunted pastime, we don't do this for any particular reason except that it's the perfectly natural thing to do. We're curious, and who knows when we might have to use the insight we've gleaned. Whether we mean to be or not, we are all of us intuitive psychologists. For con artists, though, intuitive psychology, the process of sizing up who someone is, what they're made of, what they desire, isn't a nice evolutionary byproduct or a fun way to pass the time. It's their livelihood. One of their great skills is to discern details of a victim's life without her knowledge, so that she doesn't even realize how much she's given away, and then to use those very details to impress the victim with their insight. That ability is, indeed, the first step of a con, the put-up. The moment when a confidence artist investigates and chooses his prey. And it is, in more senses than one, the most crucial step of the entire operation. Size someone up well and you can sell them anything. A magic crystal, an Egyptian curse, the Eiffel Tower. Fail to do so, and the most elaborate or attractive master plan will fall on deaf ears. Since the late 1990s, Epley has been exploring the underpinnings of intuitive judgment. We come up with instinctive explanations for other people's appearance, actions, and words all the time. But how are we actually doing it, he wondered. And how accurate is our intuition? The process, he posits, is twofold. There's person perception, being able to tell who someone is, or what psychologist Daniel Gilbert terms ordinary personology. We look at basic physical features like gender, age, and height, at facial structure, at skin tone, at body language, standing tall, hunched, leisurely, hurried, and, of course, at clothing. And then there's what Epley terms, borrowing from Daniel Wegner, mind perception. Being able to tell what others feel, what they desire, what drives and motivates them. We listen to their words and their voice. Read their gestures and their tone, infer between the lines to get a sense of their inner world. When someone gestures with her hand, we can almost immediately tell whether it means, I don't care, versus I'm angry, versus I'm thrilled. When someone activates her zygomatic major, a muscle on either side of the mouth that is almost impossible to control consciously, we can tell she is genuinely happy. When someone moves quickly, expansively, and with determination, we can tell that she's either angry or exceptionally thrilled, depending on context. If she's more lethargic and closed, it could signal boredom. Our faces are capable of some 3,000 expressions, according to Paul Ekman's estimates. And we can reliably read at least 7 of the basic contours and multiple permutations of them. From our posture to how we hold a glass of water, from our choice of outfit to how we've styled our hair and how we open the door, we throw off cues about ourselves and our minds with every step, every flicker of the eye, every choice of phrase. That is, if, like the grifter scanning the room for his prey, you're ready to catch them. While we lay people are good at the broad strokes, basics, we tend to fare worse when it comes to reading nuance. While we're good at the overt bodily cues, we are not so great at the cues of the mind. We infer entire belief systems from one rogue statement, craft personalities and backstories with no bearing on reality from one surface clue. We simplify when we should caveat and gloss where we should elaborate. Often, we use snap judgments, what Daniel Kahneman calls heuristics, when we meet someone new and end up with a superficial, highly stereotyped version of what they are like. Take Saulfield's impression of Mitchell, charming, comforting, pretty. And indeed, Mitchell is always elegant, impeccably dressed, well-coiffed and manicured, with an enticing, open smile. She relies in part on those surface cues to inspire the type of trust she will need to lure her fortune seekers. We know, theoretically, that we should pay more heed and exercise caution, that we should incorporate other people's perspectives into our own, walk a mile in their shoes, or whatever other cliché we want to invoke. But practically, we remain superbly egocentric in all our judgments. In his book, Human Knowledge, Its Scope and Its Limits, the philosopher Bertrand Russell observed, "The behavior of other people is in many ways analogous to our own, and we suppose that it must have analogous causes. We are our own prototype of being, of motivation, of behavior." People, however, are far from being a homogeneous mass. And so, when we depart from our own perspective, as we inevitably must, we often make errors, sometimes significant ones. In one series of studies, Epley and his colleagues found that people were far slower to discern a different perspective from their own, and that under time pressure, they were unlikely to do so at all. He called it egocentric anchoring. We are our own point of departure. We assume that others know what we know, believe what we believe, and like what we like. For the layperson for whom conning is far from mind, the frequent inaccuracy in judgment isn't silly or stupid. It is, quite often, adaptive. As with white lies, it is not always helpful to our own sense of self and well-being to correctly discern someone else's negative feelings or nasty thoughts. It's likewise not helpful to think their views at opposing ends from our own. We like people who are more similar to us more than those who differ. And isn't it better that the world be filled with friends rather than strangers? In a study of married couples, psychologists Jeffrey Simpson, William Ikes, and Mindo Arinha videotaped married couples as they addressed a problem point in their marriage. After, each spouse viewed the interaction, recorded her own feelings, and tried to decipher her partner's at each point in the conversation. Accuracy, it turns out, was overrated. Those who were better at reading threatening cues also felt worse about their partners and marriages by the end of the study. The less accurate actually came out ahead, as did their relationship satisfaction. We never learn to be expert people readers because that expertise can backfire spectacularly. Why form accurate judgments when the inaccurate ones make our lives far more pleasant and easy? For a con artist, however, accuracy is paramount and feelings of self-worth far less so. For him, self-worth is ingrained in his very ability to ferret out social nuance and personal vagaries better than anyone else. And there is one central factor that can override most shortcomings and make us far more accurate at figuring out who someone is and what makes her tick. Motivation. People who are motivated to be accurate, whether financially or personally, suddenly become far more adept at reading faces, bodies, and minds alike. In one set of studies, people in powerful roles failed spectacularly at reading others. But when the researchers Jennifer Overbeck and Bernadette Park gave them a motivation for accuracy, make your subordinates feel engaged and included, they were suddenly far better at person reading than they'd ever been. They were more accurate in judging employees' personalities and abilities than their counterparts who'd been instructed to pay attention to efficiency and productivity. Con artists are motivated always. They are us as our best, most perceptive selves, who've also had years of practice. They are masters of the put-up. They can read our background, our beliefs, our emotions in their shifts, even the desires we thought we'd hidden so well. When Saulfield walked into Xenia, Mitchell likely knew before she even opened her mouth that she was emotionally vulnerable. She was attuned to her every gesture, from the way she moved to the way she shook her hand. Saulfield didn't even need to mention a troubled love or work situation. To a discerning eye, it was all written on her face. On a winter evening, I made my way to a mind reading of my very own, this one from tarot cards. I knew all about the cold read, the signs that I would be giving out that would tip the reader of my future off about my inner life, and I agonized over how much to leave in the open and how much to omit. Should I take off my wedding band? Arrive without a purse? What should I wear? In the end, I opted for looking like myself, minus my name, to give the experiment an air of authenticity. Did I have any one question I wanted to focus on, my reader asked. I opted for a take on my career. Soon, the man was busy telling me all about the woes of the publishing industry, the instability, the career uncertainty, the changes that the digital world had brought with it. He was discussing my job insecurities, but made sure to temper them with optimistic interludes. Somehow, despite all the uncertainty, it would all work out. He even knew that at moments of deep panic, I thought about dropping it altogether. If the industry was crumbling, would I be able to get out in time? Of course, Mr. Tarot wasn't actually talking about publishing. He had no idea I was a writer. He was using lines that would fit most any job description, and dilemmas that most any youngish woman in the earlier stages of her career would likely ask herself. Who doesn't worry about the future of their career path? Who doesn't think these days that their industry is in a state of flux? Who hasn't thought about leaving it all behind? Each statement could have applied just as easily to any number of jobs, but to me it seemed as if he actually had insight into what precisely I did. He left me with a reassuring message. It would work out, and I didn't have to panic about losing my ability to make a living, as long as I didn't let my self-doubt get the better of me. I was my own worst enemy, and I could at any moment sabotage my own success. I had to stop those corrosive thought patterns and think instead in a more constructive, positive light. Then the world would be mine for the taking. Not bad advice. I nodded appreciatively as I walked back out to the street. Maybe there was something to this after all. The psychic, and the con artist more broadly, isn't just a master cold reader and psychologist. He is someone who has endless practice getting things right and is endlessly motivated to avoid making a glaring error. An error in the put-up, after all, is a costly one indeed. It could render the entire con ineffective. As it turns out, our best practiced selves can tell quite a bit about others, even things that might seem unbelievable. In 1988, psychologist Linda Albright and her colleagues at the University of Connecticut ran three studies to test how well motivated individuals could read one another in what she termed zero acquaintance conditions, that is, the first time they ever met. She found considerable accuracy in judgments of both extroversion and conscientiousness. Not only did observers tend to agree, but the people they were judging thought the impression representative of themselves. In another series of studies, highly motivated individuals were better at discerning the facial emotions and tone of voice of a stranger. They were, as well, more accurate at determining the stranger's internal emotional state. In 2010, Nicholas Epley and Tala Yal of Ben-Gurion University published the results of a series of experiments aimed at improving our person and mind perception skills. The title of their paper? How to Seem Telepathic. Many of our errors, the researchers found, stem from a basic mismatch between how we analyze ourselves and how we analyze others. When it comes to ourselves, we employ a fine-grained, highly contextualized level of detail. When we think about others, however, we operate at a much higher, more generalized and abstract level. For instance, when answering the same question about ourselves or others, how attractive are you, we use very different cues. For our own appearance, we think about how our hair is looking that morning, whether we got enough sleep, how well that shirt matches our complexion. For that of others, we form a surface judgment based on overall gist. So there are two mismatches. We aren't quite sure how others are seeing us, and we are incorrectly judging how they see themselves. If, however, we can adjust our level of analysis, we suddenly appear much more intuitive and accurate. In one study, people became more accurate at discerning how others see them when they thought their photograph was going to be evaluated a few months later, as opposed to the same day. While in another, the same accuracy shift happened if they thought a recording they'd made describing themselves would be heard a few months later. Suddenly, they were using the same abstract lens that others are likely to use naturally, and so they were much more perceptive about how they came off in reality, and not just in their own minds. For an enterprising mind reader, that is, the grifter mid-put-up, this skill is crucial. You have to know what cues others are using to judge you, and what cues simply don't matter. If you think you look tired that day, your confidence might go down, and your persuasiveness along with it. But if you realize that no one else will notice and instead your overall demeanor will make a much bigger difference, you can focus on the big picture, confidence fully intact. In a second series of studies, Epley and Yal looked at the opposite effect. Do we become better at reading other people when we approach them at the same intimate level of construal as we naturally do ourselves? This time, they gave photographs of other students to their subjects, telling them that the picture had been taken either earlier that day or a few months prior. Sure enough, those who thought the photographs had been taken hours earlier became much more nuanced in their judgments than those who thought they were a few months old. They were looking at others for the same fine level of detail they did in themselves. It was a relatively simple change in thought, but one that came with a high payoff. A con artist looks at everyone at that fine level. When it comes to the put-up, accuracy matters. And con men don't just want to know how someone looks to them. They want to correctly reflect how they want to be seen. What's more, confidence artists can use what they're learning as they go in order to get us to give up even more. We are more trusting of people who seem more familiar and more similar to us, and we open up to them in ways we don't to strangers. Those like us and those we know or recognize are unlikely to want to hurt us, and they're more likely to understand us. If your new acquaintance shares your taste for comedy clubs and favors the same everyday style of dress, it's a good indication that you might also be compatible in other respects. After all, tastes, habits, and lifestyle choices have to come from somewhere. Those who are very different from us, however, may have motives that aren't quite as friendly. My own psychic dropped a seemingly unrelated, "You're not originally from New York, are you?" early in our reading. "No, I'm not," I told him. "Neither was he assured me, but he wouldn't live anywhere else." I nodded in agreement. Throughout the reading, many more such similarities came to light. He, too, had been uncertain about his career. He wanted to make some changes. He was actually far more artistic and felt at times that he was selling out. But hey, he had to pay the bills. By the end, I thought him a kindred spirit. As I'm sure do most of those who emerge from his readings. Much like Sylvia Mitchell's clients saw her as a friend, someone quite like them, with problems and aspirations similar to their own. In one study, psychologist Lisa De Bruin asked people to play a sequential trust game, a game where the way you act depends on how you think your partner will act. The most famous example of the genre is the prisoner's dilemma, where everyone benefits from staying silent, but if someone talks and you don't, you fare worst of all. No player's partner, however, actually existed. What she thought was a virtual teammate was in fact a photograph that had been subtly altered in one of two ways. It was morphed to resemble either a stranger or the player herself. The more similar to her own face the picture became, the more trustworthy a player judged it to be. Look at that face. How can someone not trust and respect it? Even more surface similarities, like shared birthdays, even birth months, or names, create an effect of greater liking and greater willingness to help and comply. But both similarity and familiarity can be faked, as the con artist can easily tell you. And the more you can fake it, the more real information will be forthcoming. Similarity is easy enough. When we like someone or feel an affinity for them, we tend to mimic their behavior, facial expressions, and gestures, a phenomenon known as the chameleon effect. But the effect works the other way, too. If we mimic someone else, they will feel closer and more similar to us. We can fake the natural liking process quite well. We perpetuate minor cons every day, often without realizing it, and sometimes knowing what we do all too well. When we mirror back someone's words or interests, feign a shared affinity for a sports team, or a mutual hatred of a brand. The signs that usually serve us reliably can easily be massaged, especially in the short term. All a good con artist needs. Try honestly to see things from the other person's point of view, Dale Carnegie advised in his treatise on winning friends and influencing people, a sort of unwitting Bible for cons in training. And if you're having trouble, talk in terms of the other person's interests. Someone mentions something in passing? Latch onto it and mirror it back multifold. Did you read one cue correctly? A Floridian address, perhaps, from an unseasonable TAM? Seize on it. Do so masterfully, and you become better liked and seem more interesting yourself. Our defenses drop away. And suddenly, you have all the interests and beliefs you can work with, making the put-up a matter of a moment. Familiarity, too, can be faked, so that trust and affection, and thus a con's successful progression, follows smoothly in its wake. In April 2005, Tom Jagatic and his colleagues at Indiana State University set out to gauge who might be vulnerable to phishing attacks, or attempts to gain sensitive personal information from someone by posing as a legitimate third party, like a bank or phone company. Their targets, students at their own university. Their aim was to find out what it would take to get someone to trust you and open up. First, they looked at publicly available information on social networks. Facebook, LinkedIn, MySpace, Friendster, 2005, remember, and LiveJournal's Friend of a Friend project. Next, they sent their victims an email that seemed to come from one of their friends at the university. When they clicked on the provided link, though, it brought them to a website that was clearly not affiliated with ISU, but that still asked them for their university login credentials. An attack was considered a success if someone clicked on an email link and proceeded to enter their university username and password. Over 70% of the students entered their login information. It had, after all, come from a friend. It was, in other words, nice and familiar. It's not just typical college students. In an early study on West Point cadets, 4 out of 5 students followed a fictitious embedded link from a colonel who didn't actually exist to view their grade reports. One of Fred DeMara's preferred tactics on his many imposter adventures was something he termed papering. Before he made a request for someone's credentials, in the run-up to assuming their identity, he would paper the trail with letters, calls, and conversations, posing as various people with a tie to his assumed identity who were all reaching out to the institution in question with queries and spontaneous-seeming recommendations. That way, by the time the request came around, he was a familiar presence. People were expecting him, he seemed more trustworthy, and thus he became much more successful at attaining the precise certification he needed. His friends were only too happy to help. With time, he could also rely on some extras who made the job all the simpler. People who had, over the years, met him, been taken in, and remained willing to vouch for him, certain that this time would be different and would mark his return to legitimacy. Indeed, many times he convinced Robert Crichton that he'd gone straight, for real and for good this time, forcing Crichton to play an inadvertent shill in the papering game. "I have been really trying to get a job," he wrote in one letter in November 1960. And, of course, after their deep relationship, he'd given Crichton as a reference. Would Crichton oblige? "If they write to you, please give me a real good build-up and sign any name that strikes your fancy. On good stationery, Natch." Whether in the world of college or business, virtual or physical, the most effective way of creating an illusion of familiarity, to lull the mark into revealing ever more about himself, and thus make the put-up that much more successful, remains the same. Personal contact. Moran Cerf, now a neuroscientist, used to work as a hacker of sorts, a member of a team that helped companies determine their security vulnerabilities. "The most important part of the job," he told me, "is to first gather the human intelligence, or humint. No technical skills as such, merely skills at reading people and latching on to what they've already shared freely, albeit at times unwittingly. The more specific the information, the better and more believable it would be." Even though the attack itself was technical, the put-up remained supremely human. One woman on their team had no real technical savvy. Instead, her unique role was as head of the humint effort. She'd make friends, check schedules, research locations, gain trust, and then the team could commence their hacking efforts. All they needed, Cerf says, was one single entry point. And gaining a single entry point is quite simple if you know what you're doing. For instance, just having a brief conversation with someone, however meaningless, a simple exchange of hellos, is enough to gain their trust later on. The person you spoke with feels more familiar and thus more friendly, so you become more likely to trust her later on. In one study, seeing someone once, however briefly, even with no further interaction, made people more likely to agree to something later asked of them, just what Cerf's teammate was angling for. "You're no longer a stranger. You're that girl who had coffee at my favorite coffee place just down the street from the office. What a coincidence. Of course I'll help." Cerf's accomplice was a researcher who would report back on her findings rather than use them for nefarious purposes, but she did precisely what the confidence man does each time he begins the put-up. Profile the likely candidates to target, and then use that profile to ingratiate herself before she's made a single demand. The ease with which she was able to succeed should frighten us. It's an effect that can be achieved with even less of an effort than a casual chat over coffee. In the winter of 1967, Robert Zients, a social psychologist at Stanford University, came across an intriguing story from a Corvallis, Oregon newspaper. For 2 months, the article said, a mysterious figure had been attending a course at Oregon State University called Speech 113, Basic Persuasion. The figure had an odd appearance. It was draped entirely in a black bag. The only visible part of his, or maybe it was a her, body was the feet. They were bare. Each class, the hooded figure sat, silently, on a table in the back of the room. The professor, Charles Goetzinger, was the only one who knew its identity. The students, meanwhile, referred to the presence as the black bag. But, strange as it was, that wasn't what intrigued Zients about the story. Instead, he found himself drawn to Goetzinger's description of the students' reactions to the black bag. They had changed, according to the professor, from hostility to the black bag to curiosity, and finally to friendship. The black bag hadn't done anything, said a single word, or interacted with a single student, but their views of him changed all the same. Could it be, Zients wondered, that they'd gotten used to his presence, it was a he after all, and did that mere fact make them somehow friendlier toward him? It wasn't a new idea. In 1903, Max Meyer had played Oriental music to his students repeatedly, from 12 to 15 times. The more they heard it, the more they liked it. The effect was later replicated for classical music, unusual combinations and colors in art, and even seats in a classroom. Ever wonder why people usually stick to the same seat, even if there's no assigned seating? It's a matter of things growing on you. But these were all consciously retained. What Zients was interested in was that word mere. Could exposure without conscious processing accomplish the same thing? In 1968, Zients published the results of his research. Results that are, perhaps, one of the most important insights that advertisers, marketers, and their less scrupulous colleagues in the con have taken to heart in executing the put-up. First, he showed people series of images, Turkish nonsense words, Chinese-like characters, or photographs, depending on the study. Then he tested their liking for them. The more times they had seen them, he found, the more they liked them. He later reproduced the effect with random shapes projected onto a screen that appeared and disappeared so quickly that it was difficult to tell what exactly was being shown, and, crucially, how many times it had appeared. Over and over, people chose the shapes they had seen earlier as more pleasing, even though they had no conscious memory of ever having seen them and couldn't distinguish old from new at above-chance levels. Zients called it the mere exposure effect. Familiarity breeds affection. And affection is a fount of the personal information so essential to the successful put-up. Mere exposure has real evolutionary value. If we've seen something before and it didn't kill us, well, our chances are probably better than with something we can't predict. The better the devil you know type of reasoning. Conrad Lorenz, the Nobel-winning ethnologist, showed that a raven would react with an immediate escape response in the presence of any new object, be it a camera, a stuffed polecat, or anything else. But after a few hours and repeated exposure, the bird began to approach. Infants do the same thing. In one early study, babies cried when they heard a new sound for the first time. By the fourth time, they were more curious than anything else. Alas, like many normally adaptive tendencies, our reaction to mere exposure is all too easy to co-opt. It certainly doesn't hurt when we go beyond mere exposure to the level of conversation, and not only have a conversation, but then have accurate recall for the details when we make our next bid for trust. We like it when we feel someone knows the real us. Something as simple as remembering our name can instantly turn a confidence artist from persona non grata to someone we like, admire even, and certainly someone we're willing to help. In one series of experiments, people were more likely to buy something from a relative stranger if that relative stranger happened to recall their name. They viewed the mere recall as a compliment. Clearly, they were important enough to note. And if that person thought so, then it was a very discerning person indeed. As that masterful manipulator Dale Carnegie put it, remember that a person's name is to that person the sweetest and most important sound in any language. knowing us is the con man's bread and butter. In fact, some cons are based entirely on false knowledge. A seasoned technique? Pretend you're someone's relative and that you met at a wedding. All you need to know is the name of the wedding party in question, and you're golden. We would much rather fake knowledge than appear ungracious. Herman Melville hit upon the power of such false familiarity in his novel of the con, The Confidence Man. Aboard a steamship, a con artist in various guises approaches select passengers. As he learns something about one from talking to another, or from simple observation, he uses it in his next conversation, pretending to be an old business acquaintance or social associate. It works like a charm. In February 1960, Mr. and Mrs. Alan James Blau of Pittsfield, Massachusetts, placed an official announcement in the New York Times. Their son, Andrew, had become engaged to a girl from California, a Miss Kelly Smith Hines. The date was set for June. The family was flooded with well-meaning congratulations. What a happy life event. Some days later, Mrs. Blau received a phone call. It was Kelly's aunt, Nancy. She was passing through Pittsfield and wanted to meet Andrew's parents. Mrs. Blau was a bit miffed. Why hadn't anyone warned her? But happy to oblige. She met Aunt Nancy at the bus station, took her to lunch, had a wonderful conversation. Aunt Nancy told her about her house in Carmel, inviting her to stay when it came time for the wedding. They talked about wedding gifts. Spode china, Aunt Nancy suggested. A wonderful choice, Mrs. Blau concurred. At the end of the afternoon, it was time to drive the visiting guest back to the bus station. Alas, Aunt Nancy was absent-minded. She only had traveler's checks with her. Would Mrs. Blau kindly loan her $50 for the remaining trip? Well, of course. She was almost family. Later that evening, Mrs. Blau called her son in New York. Why hadn't he told her about Aunt Nancy, she demanded, slightly annoyed. Andrew was surprised. Aunt who? He called Kelly. Kelly drew a blank. Kelly called her mother. Her mother was perplexed. Mrs. Hines called her mother, Kelly's grandmother. The mystery only deepened. Aunt Nancy, it turned out, was a professional wedding imposter. She would read announcements in newspapers, visit parents, and come away with meals, housing, and small loans in the process. Thus, she made her modest living. Today, Kelly is of a more forgiving bent. She feels that the poor woman was single and bored and just looking to be part of other people's lives for a little while. Aunt Nancy is the perfect embodiment of faked familiarity. Do your homework and the put-up falls rapidly into place. You don't have to expend much effort on the groundwork that forms the basis of real familiarity, and instead reap the same psychological benefits by simply appearing to be closer than you are, and to know more than you do. Cerf has been out of the hacking-for-hire business for over a decade. But recently, he said, he checked in with some of his old teammates. Hadn't their jobs, he wondered, gotten far more difficult over time, as companies and people alike became more tech-savvy? Quite the contrary. They'd grown easier. Now the human effort didn't even require all that much physical legwork. All you needed to do was successfully friend someone on Facebook or connect with them socially on some other network. And if you could get them to see you as friendly long enough to click on just one link or download just one file, the whole system would eventually be yours. One entry point is all that is required. We reveal a great deal about ourselves without necessarily realizing it, and everything we reveal becomes the perfect fodder for the well-executed put-up, to then be used to gain our trust. Even a novice could find out, say, our bidding history or shopping preferences on eBay, and any public gift list, be it on Amazon or a wedding or baby registry, can give further color to not only our desires but our important life events. Security questions like mother's maiden name, too, can be easily hacked by a quick search through public records. All a con artist needs is to do his homework. And to a con artist, that legwork is always worth it, no matter how difficult or devious the process. The put-up, after all, is the foundation of his livelihood. On July 14, 1975, Sandeep Madan lost his younger brother, Gunesh, known as Chuchu, to the family. He was only 13, and his death came as an utter shock. Their mother, understandably, was devastated. She was distraught with grief that lasted for decades, Madan told me, and sought spiritual comfort. In the spring of 1978, her depression still acute, she was offered a brief glimmer of hope. A close friend of the family's told them that a famous sadhu, a Hindu aesthetic purported to have divine powers, was visiting New Delhi. His name was Bhutnath, and he could bring the whole family to see him. The Madan family arrived in Bhutnath's temporary residence. Outside his audience chamber, the anteroom was filled with followers and would-be supplicants. The excitement was palpable. Some exchanged confidences about their hopes for the visit. Others extolled his past exploits. This was a true holy man. After a brief wait, they were shown into the presence of Bhutnath himself. "We met him as strangers he knew nothing about," Madan says. "But somehow, he was soon sharing insights that there was no apparent way he could have known. He had an uncanny knowledge about my mother having lost her child and being in torment about it. He saw," he said, "the boy's soul. He was in the afterlife. He was happy. And he wanted his mother to be happy too, at peace at last." She was unnerved. Who wouldn't be? She hadn't shared any of this. But she was also relieved. Maybe they had found a holy man after all. Bhutnath suddenly shifted his attention. He looked straight at Sandeep. He had just glimpsed a slice of his future, he said. He would be joining the IAS, India Civil Service. Sandeep was shocked. It was indeed his aspiration. How had he known? The audience was over. Bhutnath waved his arms and out of thin air, prasad appeared before them. Holy food, some nuts and raisins. He gave them his blessing and sent them on their way. Had they just been in the presence of divinity? Something about the visit didn't sit quite right. At the last minute, Sandeep's new wife, Anita, and an aunt, Ranjit, his mother's younger sister, had decided to join in the excursion. And about the two of them, Bhutnath had been both wrong and clueless. How could he have been so right about some things and so completely off base about others? The answer was far less holy. The same family friend who had set up the visit had also been giving Bhutnath information to prepare him for the meeting. And the details he hadn't been able to glean? Well, those anteroom supplicants weren't quite what they seemed either. They were his associates posing as guileless hangers-on to pick what crumbs of knowledge might fall from the actual visitors. For several months, Madan recalls, Bhutnath was the toast of New Delhi. Everyone was excited. Magazines and newspapers wrote about him. Wealthy donors flocked to his side. But then he made one slip too many and fell as quickly as he rose, to be replaced in short order by the next miracle worker. Even if there's no Facebook and no willing friend, well, con artists are enterprising. No piece of data is too small for the put-up, and no amount of effort to obtain it too large. In 1898, Molly Burns, a schoolteacher and typist, fell ill on a trolley car in uptown Manhattan. Luckily, a good Samaritan was there to help. Elizabeth Fitzgerald took pity on the sick girl and walked her to her hotel room. "Was she not from around here?" she asked as she led her down the sidewalk. "Actually, she was," Burns admitted. "It was just that she'd had a fight with her mother and had left home in a huff, hence the hotel room." Fitzgerald sympathized. Mothers were tough. And after checking to make sure that Molly had what she needed, took her leave. She had to get on with her day. Except her day, oddly enough, would now center on her chance acquaintance. In Harlem, where she lived, Fitzgerald was known as Madame Zingara, the famed clairvoyant of Harlem. And she couldn't let an opportunity like this pass her by. It was a thing of a moment for a practiced hand like herself to track down Burns's mother. And from there, over a nice cup of sympathetic tea, to learn that the topic of the fight had been an affair that Burns was having with a married man, one E.T. Harlow. Madame Zingara promptly called on Burns. She'd had a vision, she told her, and that vision included shocking details of her personal life, which, for a small fee, she would keep to herself. Burns, eager to preserve her reputation, parted with several $100, almost everything she had. A week later, Madame Zingara called again. She now knew that Burns was going to be named as a correspondent in a divorce suit. But again, for a small fee, she could keep that from coming to pass. Burns promptly gave up the rest of her savings. She wasn't the only one. The clairvoyant was very good at what she did. She had convinced the entire family that they would all be ruined by a disgraceful divorce. They were lucky, though. For $1,000, she managed to keep ruination at bay. But she went one step too far when she tracked down Harlow himself. She had had a revelation, she told him. He was having an affair with Molly Burns, and evil spirits were working against him. The cost of an exorcism, at a special rate, $500. Unlike the Burnses, Harlow went to the police, and Madame Zingara went to jail. Not for long, though. One of her clients, Henry Strauss, whom she'd convinced she could help find gold, supplied her bail, and she didn't lose any time in fleeing to Chicago. She was arrested again in the winter of 1899, escaped again, and was finally caught and sentenced for fraud in 1900. In the hands of an artist, the mind-reading game comes full circle. The more familiar and similar someone seems, the more you like them, the more you share with them, the more information the con artist has to feed back to you. And the circle begins anew. But heaven forbid the mark himself should make use of the same approach and see through game and artist both. To avoid that happening, the confidence man becomes an expert in tripping us up. Even as he perfects the put-up, he knows how to make us even worse at reading social cues than we normally are. Call it the anti-put-up. Put up the mark, all the while making sure he can't do the same thing right back. Things that trip us up, Epley has found, include pressure, time, emotional, situational, and power. When we're feeling pressure, we grow far less able to think logically and deliberately. When we're feeling more powerful, we tend to feel as if we don't need others quite as much, and our ability to read their minds and the cues they throw off falters. In a version of the self-monitoring task, the cue on the forehead, Adam Galinsky and his colleagues asked people to draw an E on their foreheads. If you just thought about a time when you were in a high-powered position, you drew the E from your own perspective, prongs facing right. If, however, you'd just been reflecting on times when you had relatively little power, the letter flipped toward your conversation partner's point of view. A flipped letter, in turn, signals a greater willingness and ability to take others' point of view into account, and a better ability to read the social signs they throw off. There's nothing a con artist likes to do more than make us feel powerful and in control. We are the ones calling the shots, making the choices, doing the thinking. They are merely there to do our bidding. And so, as we throw off ever more clues, we ourselves become increasingly blind to the clues being thrown off by others. Take Damara's stint in the Royal Canadian Navy. Part of his success, that is, the reason he wasn't unmasked at once and managed to slip by with what seemed like a semblance of medical knowledge, was that he'd mastered the power dynamic perfectly and loved to make those around him feel like the experts in control. He'd deferred to another doctor's expertise in drafting the field guide for soldiers who didn't have ready medical attention. The fellow doctor was so much more knowledgeable, he'd told him, and he felt like a neophyte in comparison. The ploy worked like a charm, and Damara received all the free medical advice he could want. Later, on the ship, he did much the same thing with the captain and senior officers, always deferring to their power and seniority, even though he too had a claim to an elevated status. That way, he could glean all he could from them, and they, in turn, would be too flattered to scrutinize him too closely. Another thing that detracts from our mind-reading prowess, money. Specifically, thoughts of it. In a series of 9 studies, psychologist Kathleen Vose, the chair of marketing at the University of Minnesota's Carlson School of Management, found that people who were reminded of money, even in passing, ended up paying less attention to others and, indeed, wanted to put more distance between themselves and others. Con artists are well aware of this, and so they make financial woes or windfalls front and center of their put-up, much as Sylvia Mitchell did with her victims, bringing up financial considerations right away. They had too great an attachment to money. They were in an emotional predicament because they had an unhealthy relationship with material possessions, and so on. While they were busy thinking through the implications, she was busy reading them. Lee Chung was a businesswoman from Singapore who had earned a master's degree in business from NYU. Her life, however, wasn't going quite as planned. Professionally, her job seemed at a standstill. It was 2007. She was working between 80 and 100 hours a week at a high-profile investment bank. It was a good job. It paid well. So many others were out of work. She should have been happy. But her countless hours seemed wasted somehow. She missed her family, especially her mother who had fallen ill and needed care. Romantically, too, there were some bumps. She had her eye on a coworker. She knew that was never a good idea, but she couldn't help herself. The coworker, alas, was oblivious to her affections, as these things so often go. And there was one more hitch. She was a fellow female. Chung was coming to terms with a new sexual identity, and one not particularly welcome in her home culture. She felt lonely, lost, vulnerable, and exposed. And there it was, that warm, beckoning yellow glow from the hanging lanterns, the same beaded curtain, the same welcoming, reassuring smile that told her she wasn't only welcome here, she was safe. Sylvia Mitchell could sense right away that Chung's energy field was all out of whack. Negative energy, she told Chung, permeated her existence. But there was hope. Sylvia could get rid of it, if only she agreed to put $18,000 in a jar for Sylvia to hold, just as an exercise. It was a gesture of good faith that would help clarify the dark forces that surrounded her. Then Mitchell went even further. In a past life, she told Chung, her family had somehow wronged the object of her crush. That was why she now found herself in the throngs of unrequited love. But a happy future together was possible, she assured her. She could sense it. To make it real, however, would require work. Real work. Work that couldn't be accomplished in a single visit, or even just a few. Over the course of the next 2 years, the two women would meditate together to better focus their energy on future love-full bliss. On her own, Mitchell said she would perform various rites to help the process along. It would take time, she warned. The slight in the past life had been severe. Time and $128,000, which, bit by bit, Chung surrendered to her new confidant. As their relationship deepened, perhaps unsurprisingly, Chung's problems were showing no signs of abatement. Instead, they had only grown more severe. Her workplace love complained of sexual harassment, and soon after, Chung was fired. Her mother was still sick. Chung was without love, without a job, short on funds. Mitchell had taken most of what she had. Neither Saulfield nor Chung was a particularly gullible woman. They were professionally successful, smart, good at what they did, and, as they would both later publicly state, they were highly skeptical of Sylvia Mitchell. But they were also vulnerable emotionally. She was just what they needed, just when they needed it. And she was just so good. I feel as an intelligent, educated woman, it is one of the most humiliating things that's ever happened to me, Saulfield later confessed. In some sense, the role of a psychic is easier than that of many confidence artists when it comes to the put-up. The marks, in a certain respect, come pre-selected. Just by walking into the parlor, you've shown yourself to be open to belief and suggestion, and you're obviously searching for an easy answer to your problem or situation. That's true of other types of rackets as well. In the age of the internet, it's easier than ever to clear the first hurdle of the put-up, those who respond to the false ads, emails, or other phishing schemes. Gone is the need to be psychologically savvy from first glance. All you need is to be savvy enough to build an alluring storefront or craft a message that will hook your potential prey. The bad grammar and seemingly implausible notes? Those aren't from stupidity. They're actually well thought out beforehand. Scammers have learned